Welcome into another edition of the Dane and Victory podcast, only available on musketeerreport.com. I am Rick, he is Dan, and Dan, for this first edition of the podcast in the year 2015, we are joined by the legend, Brian Snow.
I know the pleasure is all yours.
Well, I have no idea. I was thinking about this. I have no idea when the last podcast was. So
it was
we'll
after
just
the
say
Providence game. It was post-game Providence.
Providence. They haven't played Providence yet.
That would be
a neat trick. The Muskies are 11.
Last year.
We're recording this on Thursday, January the 8th. The Musketeers are currently 11-4, 2-1 in Big East play. In Big East play, they beat Georgetown 70-53 on New Year's Eve. Lost to DePaul 71-68 the following Saturday, and then bounced back with a 69-58 win over Seton Hall on Wednesday. The Muskies will be back in action with two road games in the upcoming week. They're at Hinkle to play the Butler Bulldogs on Saturday afternoon, and then on Wednesday night they visit the high-flying Villanova Wildcats.
That is correct. But first, Dan, before we even get into this show, I mean, there's a ton to break down. There were all types of things thrown out on the message board, and some things got a little wild. People are wanting to know about next year and stuff, and it's like, guys, there's like three games that we haven't even discussed yet. We'll probably stick to this year right now. But first, we got a special guest tonight, and this is a big one. I'm pretty excited about this one, so I'll just let you go ahead and bring us in here.
Okay, so our special guest tonight, I guess, to preface this, we've had Andy Mack and we've had Byron Larkin, but we really only had those guys to get to our guest tonight. He is a 1979 graduate of Xavier University, 2006 inductee into the Xavier Athletics Hall of Fame. He is the voice of the Musketeers on 700 WLW and 55 KRC, host of the Chris Mack Show, and truly a legend in Xavier basketball history, Joe Sunderman. Joe, thanks for joining us tonight.
I appreciate the introduction. You're very generous.
Well, Joe, this is a big show to have you on because, as I've told you before, what started me wanting to get into the media industry was I wanted to be a college play-by-play guy. And, of course, my father graduated from Xavier. He watched you play there. And so I grew up listening to you and Andy Mack and then you and Byron call the games. And I tried to emulate you. You were one of my favorite guys growing up. So this is a lot of fun to get to talk to you. And I want to talk to you, first of all, this is where we started with Andy Mack. So we've got to start with you. What do you remember about the number one in the country, number two in the city call? It's the best call in Xavier history.
It is, and I tried to run over right over it, if you remember, if you hear it. Yeah. Andy started, and he paused, and I was trying to say something, and Andy had that fabulous line all ready to go, and so finally I was quiet, and he was able to get it out. I remember the moment, I remember the game, I remember certain events in Xavier history you have imprinted in your mind, you can run back as sort of a tape in your mind, and that's one of them, quite frankly.
Is that the one that stands out to you the most when you think back on broadcasting moments, or is there one more recent, now that you've been doing the play-by-play, that really sticks out to you as a great call?
No, the West Virginia game was a lot of fun with Byron when he encouraged B.J. Raymond to shoot at the top of the key, a three-pointer that he made. That was fabulous. Yeah, Andy Mack, I've been really blessed in terms of working with Andy Mack and Byron Larkin. You couldn't ask for better partners, and Byron's a great broadcaster. He has a wonderful insight to the game. In fact, if you want to play basketball, if you can sit next to Byron for about 10 years and just soak up his knowledge of the game, you'd be a much better basketball player when you finally start to play.
How many more points would you have scored in your career had you talked to Byron first?
I don't know. I think a few more. I don't know how many more. I'm not going to venture a guess on that, but I guarantee you I would have scored more.
It's just Joe, hold on. Joe, there's no way you would have scored more because Byron would have never passed you the ball.
Oh, if I were playing with Byron?
Yeah.
That's a good question. You know what, though? You know, I tell Byron he never shot enough because he shot over 50% for his career, right around that.
Yeah.
So if I'm coaching Byron, I'd say, hey, you need to shoot until you lower that to about 47%.
Yeah.
So I would actually ask him to shoot more so we'd score more points, win more games is the way I'd look at it.
Joe, you've been doing the Xavier radio broadcast, I think, for 26 years now. First, as you mentioned, as sort of the color commentator with Andy Mack, and then transitioning over to the play-by-play role. Can you talk a little bit about how you got into broadcasting after your Xavier career ended?
Well, when I played at Xavier, I played for 2 years and hurt my knee for a year, and I sat out an entire year, had a knee operation, so I was basically redshirted for a year, and I was invited to do some high school games during that time. And just totally by fate, really. And I enjoyed doing it. Bill Meredith was the play-by-play guy at the time. And the first game I ever did was an Elder High School, LaSalle High School game. And I went to LaSalle High School, and it was over at LaSalle High School. And when I talked to Bill, he just said, I need you to come broadcast. And I said, I really don't want to do that. He said, no, I need you there on Friday night. And I showed up. I said, now what do I do? He said, when I tap on the table, you talk. When I tap again, it's time to be quiet. And that's pretty much how it started. And I knew about 10 minutes into it, I thought to myself, I'm really enjoying this a lot more than I thought I would. And 2 years later, after I played my junior and senior year, Bob Stack was looking for a former player to get involved, and somebody recommended. Actually, it was Paul recommended. Why don't you give Joe Sunderman a chance? And I've been there ever since. And that was actually back in 1981, I think. So it's been a long time, and it's been a lot of fun.
Joe, let's bring it up to speed with this year, the 2014-15 edition of the Musketeers. We're coming off a very exciting, critical, I think, win over Seton Hall just last night. What have been your overall impressions of how Xavier's played this year, and especially looking forward to what's a pretty daunting next 3 or 4 weeks, a lot of road trips in the Big East?
Well, first of all, I think it's a great shooting team, which makes for a very exciting basketball. Even against Seton Hall, the Musketeers, I think, made 3 of 15 three-pointers, but they made consecutive three-pointers. And I think the three-point shot in college basketball, the ability to make that on a regular basis and defend it, is absolutely huge. Now, this team also impresses me as being very young. So when you go on the road to play consistently for 40 minutes, that's almost something you learn to do in college basketball, where you get a lead and you don't let up. You stay focused the entire time. You get used to the travel on the road a little bit, which is not a huge adjustment, but it is an adjustment. And I like this ball club. I like the fact that they share the basketball. I think the players enjoy playing with each other, and I think that shows on the court. And I think the senior leadership, Matt Stainbrook and D. Davis, is very, very strong.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those two guys, Joe, because those are probably D. Davis especially is one of the biggest hot button topics on my message board. And then more recently, we've been talking a lot about Matt Stainbrook. Let's start with D. I think it's pretty general and understood by most people who understand the game that D. Davis is underappreciated at Xavier and what he does for this team. What have been your thoughts on the way he's played this year? Because I think there's been some ups and downs, but I think it's almost like, we've talked about this, it's almost like an Andy Dalton mode, where fans are looking for something to pick, and he makes one mistake in a game, and it completely negates the 10 good things he does for this team. I think when he's not on the court, they've really struggled offensively.
I think your question is very accurate as to how I feel about him. When he's not on the court, they do struggle. I think any college basketball player, pro basketball player, any basketball player, I mean, is going to make mistakes once in a while. That's just the nature of the game. In fact, every team's going to have turnovers. They're just trying to limit those to about 12 a game and not let them get excessive. I really admire D. Davis. I think he gets everything out of every ounce of talent that God gave him. He's always putting 100% on the floor. Against Seton Hall, he played a magnificent game. I do think he is instrumental to the success, though, in making the good decisions, getting the ball to the right players, and that he needs to continue to do. There's no question about it. He played great defense against Seton Hall, also. I'm a big D. Davis fan.
Then you take a look at Stainbrook this year, and I think really, you know, Matt Stainbrook last year, this team struggled so much to score the basketball that without Stainbrook, you couldn't even think about them beginning to function offensively, so you never would even question whether he should be on the court or not. This year, this team scores so much more easily that I think now you start looking at, okay, where are they struggling? And it's obviously been on the defensive end, and you kind of look at their weakest link. And some of the games, especially when you look at maybe the Auburn game and the DePaul game, Stainbrook has really had some issues. What are your overall thoughts on his play, Joe? Do you feel maybe there's some limiting of minutes they need to do to keep him fresher? Do you think he's struggled with his knee? I know a couple people have asked me about that. I haven't heard anything about his knee giving him issues, but what have been your thoughts about his overall play, especially the games, you know, where he hasn't been as good, like last night, as he was against Seton Hall?
Well, I think defensively, against Seton Hall, Xavier made some changes in the rotations, and it helped Matt out defensively. where he doesn't have to be maybe at the top of the key as much as under the basket, and trying to be, in a sense, two places at one time. He's very, very valuable to this ball club. And I do like the fact they can bring Jalen Reynolds in. And you'll see it a lot where they play offense, defense, where Jalen comes in defensively. He'll come out if they get Matt in for an offensive possession. So it's interesting if you're studying the game, just how Coach Mack uses those two talents as to what they can bring to the equation at that particular time in the ball game. I thought it was interesting against Seton Hall that Matt Stainbrook stayed lower into the post, especially in the second half, and did a great job trying to post up deeper on the block and not letting himself, in a sense, sort of wander out to the perimeter where he catches the ball maybe 15 feet from the basket as opposed to 10 feet from the basket. And that made a huge difference, I thought, late in the ball game against Seton Hall. I think he's having a very good senior year. I do think that he needs to pay attention to remember to post up low. It's what the coaches have been asking for him to do. It makes the team better as a whole. And I really am intrigued by this ball club in the bench and the combination of players you can bring at various times, whether you bring in Sean O'Mara or Brandon Randolph or J.P. McCurich, Jalen Reynolds. You can give so many different looks. And it's exciting to watch. I think this team has great potential. I don't think they're playing their best basketball yet. And the real improvement can come on the defensive side.
Joe, one guy who I think could be a defensive difference maker for this team is Jalen Reynolds, and we've seen him have some success. He had a great game. I think he had a great second half against Georgetown, against Seton Hall. Chris referred to him in the postgame show with you as a little bit of a space cadet in the first half, but he came back and refocused himself in the second. Do you feel the same way I do, that we're just waiting for that light bulb to come on and he's going to be almost, if not dominant, a guy that's going to be out there more often than not contributing?
Yes, I do. And in, you know, if you're watching every game, you're seeing a little bit of improvement almost every time out. And if you watch him score, a lot of the times in the post when he catches it, he goes up for a jump hook shot or maybe a fadeaway 15-footer. His shots that he makes many times are, quite frankly, there's no defense against him. I think he needs to learn how to make himself a better target in the post so he can catch the ball more often in a better position. But he's fun to watch. Even the play that didn't count yesterday after Miles Davis against Seton Hall drove for a driving layup, missed a shot, and Jalen Reynolds dunks the miss, and ultimately it was a foul called on a defensive player on Miles Davis' initial attempt at the bucket. Just an incredible play. His athleticism is off the charts. And in my opinion, he's learning to play better pretty much every day as he goes to practice and plays. But his potential is just absolutely amazing.
Yeah, he really has. Seems like he's come on in the last several games.
Who could stop his jump hook? If he throws a jump hook at you, who in the country is going
to
block?
Well, we've talked about that. I mean, with his ability to elevate and his length, that's literally an unstoppable move no matter what level of basketball. I mean, there's two or three guys in the NBA that can maybe contest that shot, and he's not going to play Anthony Davis anytime soon. So,
and he's going back to
Jalen, he runs the court for his size. He can really get between the rim and the opposite rim as quick as anybody that I've seen in a long time. And that's another great advantage. I mean, he can guard on the perimeter. He can do an awful lot of great things. He really can.
And, Joe, I thought one of the key things about the Seton Hall game for X in the first half, when they were getting a little bit sluggish offensively, was when they had that run, about a two-minute run, where they got like three transition opportunities with Trayvon Blewett, Remy Abel running the wings, and D kind of springing the ball from midcourt or from the Xavier three-point line. Can you talk a little bit about the potential this team has for scoring in transition and how important it is from a defensive perspective to get some of those turnovers that lead to those quick transition opportunities?
Well, whether it's turnovers or rebounds, I thought actually the transition offense won the game against Seton Hall.
Yes.
And I'm referring to the Miles Davis three on the right side of the floor. Because that was basically in transition where he quickly ran, spotted up in front of the coaches over there on the right side, caught a pass in transition before the defense could get back, marking match up, and buried a three. And that was right after Abel hit a three. I like this team when they run. I like when J.P. McCure, from an entertainment standpoint and a scoring standpoint, gets in the open court. You never know what might happen, and he's very good at it. And Remy Abel runs the sidelines at a tremendous rate and is very effective once he catches it.
Well, and Joe, going back to the Miles Davis shot that you're talking about, I mean, we see them literally do that every single practice, where, you know, they're taking off and coaches are telling them to sprint hard up the court because for that exact reason, you outrun the defense like Miles did, get set up, and D's alert, passes ahead instead of dribbling it up the court, and they get an open three to put a dagger in the game. I mean, that's just something where, as the coaching staff, you know they were pleased because it's like, finally, that type of thing sunk through, something you do every single day over and over again. It literally won you a game, quite possibly, there.
Well, the Seton Hall game had a feeling to me like it was being played like molasses or in a mud pit or whatever. Just, you know, had a hard time getting going. You could tell from the crowd was very quiet. But you get in the open court like that, you get the crowd into the ball game, you free up your offense, and it flows so much more easily. And I'm hoping as this team moves on through the season that you see more and more of those opportunities being taken advantage of. You asked me about D. Davis earlier. Mm. I think he does a great job when he gets an outlet pass, a long rebound. His eyes are forward. He does a terrific job of passing forward and transition opportunities.
Yep.
Hey, Joe, one more question from my perspective about this year's team is this, and this is something we've talked about on this show a few times. You guys, I think, have hit on it on the Chris Mack show. But, you know, let's say we're in 2 weeks. Xavier's playing a big road game in Big East play. They're down a point, 20 seconds left. What lineup do you have on the floor?
What lineup do I have on the floor?
Yeah,
for offense, I have Trayvon Blewett for starters. We didn't talk much about Trayvon, but I just think he's a joy to watch also. Certainly Matt Stainbrook, Alec Remy Abel, D. Davis. And that gets kind of tough. Miles Davis. Am I allowed more than five? I'm also J.P. McCurry, if you need some creativity. That's just it about this ball club. You can go pretty deep.
Well,
you have a lot of contributors, and that ultimately makes for a very, very good team. This team, if they can stay away from the flu, which sounds kind of silly, but I mean, that's throughout the country and throughout the city, just get healthy. We've got all their components available. But I like Blue and Stainbrook, Abel and D. Davis, and maybe Miles Davis. I like them.
And that's kind of
outside, maybe for a three.
When I think about the close losses they've had, I kind of wonder if the variety of options that they have has I don't want to say it's hurt them, but they still seem like the coaching staff, at least, is still trying to figure out what the best combinations are for certain situations. It's not a bad problem to have, but it may have hampered them a little bit in some of those close games.
Well, I think absolutely that's sort of the case, where it's a growth process you go through, and it's, I think that's why you look at those losses, and they've been close losses and not 9 and 10 point losses, and that's why they're somewhat encouraging, regardless of the fact that they came against Auburn and DePaul. Because, you know, you go back to the Auburn game and you think at the end of the game they put the ball in Remy Abel's hands, and it made sense because he had been getting to the line, getting fouled almost every time he drove the basketball. But at the same time, you find out he maybe doesn't have quite the feel in a situation like that, where if the play gets foiled the way they downed the ball screen and didn't let him go off it as they had planned, he maybe doesn't read the situation as well as a Miles Davis or a D. Davis would have. So I think there's a lot of feeling out and growth process with this team, because they don't have that good. Last year was Samaje, no question. You don't have to figure out who shoots the ball. This year, there's a few things to figure out, and there's a feeling out process that has to take place.
Well, the five guys that I named, if any one of those five takes a shot at the end of the game to try to tie it or win it,
you can't
be upset.
It doesn't
bother me at all. Yeah. Where last year, you're right, it was Samaje was your guy. That was certainly your first choice, no question about it. I do think at the end of the game, if the clock weighs heavy on players, and when you're in the middle of your move, you know it's down to 3 seconds or 2 seconds, but you're not quite sure, absolutely where the clock is. And, for example, in the Auburn game, Remy Abel makes a great drive in regulation, I believe, if my memory serves me correct, to tie the game up. Gets in the same position after the second overtime, and he's trying to drive to the basket, and suddenly there's a double team. And perhaps if he'd have kicked the ball over to Miles Davis, he might have hit a good look. He's certainly easy for me to say, but the more experience you get in those situations, the better you can handle it. And this team has hit quite a few of those. As you say, they're 11-4, and of those four games, you can make a case a few different plays here and there, and they have no losses. But that's not the way sports typically goes, and you're not going to win them all. But this team is interesting that way, and they are young, and they're still defining roles. Watch this, and certainly when you lose those games, you kind of reminisce and you think, doggone it, why couldn't they have done such and such? But back in October when you talked to me about this ball club, I'd say, I think they'll hit their stride around the middle of February or maybe the end of January because they're so young. And the reality is they are playing a lot of freshmen and they're still meshing together a lot of new players, although you've played a lot of games now too. So it's time to really start finding your stride and finding your roles. And I mean, they're 11-4. And I'm excited about this ball club. I certainly enjoy watching them play.
Joe, what's your favorite Big East city to travel to?
Gosh, I like them all. You know what? That is the greatest thing about this league. Because you're going to Philadelphia, probably Washington, D.C. But I like New York. I like Philadelphia, Milwaukee, Chicago. And probably the best thing about this league is the locations we get to go to watch basketball games. I mean, you can't ask for any more. I'm thoroughly enjoying the second year of the Big East.
All right, Joe. Well, we kept you on way longer than I promised, but it was so much fun. I do appreciate you doing this, and hopefully we can do it again soon.
I'd love to do it again, and I thoroughly enjoyed it myself, Rick. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks a lot, Joe. Appreciate it.
So thanks again to Joe Sunderman, the voice of the Muskies, for appearing on the podcast. We really appreciate it. Some great insights there. Did anyone notice that Joe talked about how important shooting the three and defending the three was? I think I've been beating that drum for the last 2 years on this show. So I feel a little bit, I feel like my...
Vindicated?
I feel like my almost negative basketball knowledge was vindicated. I guess it's like a broken clock being right twice a day or something, whatever the expression is.
I just wish my voice sounded like Joe Sunderman's.
Yeah, you either have it or you don't.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome.
All right, so when you look at this team at this point, guys, it seems like there are two takes that people that have sort of coalesced around this team over the last couple weeks, and it doesn't seem
definition
like
definition of that word, please.
Coming strong early with the word game.
Can I get a definition?
Come together.
Okay, formed. Good.
There are two possible takes, and you know this is a hot take podcast. We don't go down the middle.
No.
So take number one. This is the Brian Snow take on this season so far, that Xavier's a top level team. They're very close to a breakout. You look at the computer rankings, the RPI, the KenPom rankings, everything else. They show a team that is that at least as far as their peripheral stats are very good. They've lost some close games, but every one of their wins has been by double digits. There's a luck factor in those close games, and if a few bounces had gone another way, we wouldn't be talking about any concerns over Xavier right now. They've got lots of opportunities coming up in the Big East and with the UC game, and lots of other teams both in the Big East and around the country have been suffering bad losses in conference early. Trayvon Blewett's back in rhythm. We're seeing good signs from Jalen, more consistency from D. Xavier is ready to make the leap. There is no reason for concern. That's take number one. Take number two is, this is the take that probably is the louder of the two takes right now, and that is that Xavier is basically a travesty and a sham, completely incapable of doing anything away from Cintas Center. They've had three terrible losses to DePaul, Auburn, Long Beach State. They're 8-17 in their last 25 games away from Cintas Center, 0-4 in close games. They have five of their next seven on the road, and X won only one of the five games at those venues last year with three blowout losses. The team plays with no poise or toughness on the road. There's probably some hashtags I could throw in there. You know, lack of toughness, in-game adjustments.
Adjustments!
And it just doesn't seem like there's much of it seems like those are the two camps that people tend to be in right now. I feel like more people are probably in the optimistic camp, but the loudest people are in the pessimistic camp. So I think we can throw out that sort of bipolar way of looking at this team. Snow, let's start with you. What's your assessment of where things stand on January the 8th, and what do you expect to see over the next 2 months in Big East play?
I mean, for me, I guess I know I was credited with being the optimist. How weird is that? But, you know, for me, I think kind of both camps, if you will, have a good point. This team's really talented. They're really good. They're capable of beating anyone not named Kentucky and Duke. But you get them away from home, and they're just a different team. I think it's a mental toughness issue. Now, can they fix that? Probably. Can things go in a positive direction? Absolutely. But right now, it's a mental toughness issue, away from home, where if things aren't going their way, they don't do real well. And they have to find a way to beat a team not named Missouri away from home. They just have to. And that starts on Saturday against the Butler Bulldogs. It's not going to be an easy game. It's not necessarily a game they should win, but it's a game they need to win, not for their NCAA tournament resume, not for like the season's going to be over if they lose Hinkle Fieldhouse. But at some point in time, this team needs to turn the corner away from home and say, we can beat good teams. To this point, they have not done that. They haven't done it basically in 3 years. And if they don't start doing it, when is it going to happen?
Rick?
Yeah, I mean, that no one is making the case that this team is playing well away from home or that isn't an issue. Like, I don't know. The people that get carried away with, like, saying everyone's a MAC apologist, I don't think anyone's being an apologist, really. I haven't seen anyone making the claim that this team is doing what it needs to do away from the Cintas Center. But when you look around the country, if you only want a team that wins every game, then you have to go cheer for Kentucky now, because there aren't many teams that do that. Like, every team is struggling. Oh, did you hear what Willard said to me last night when I asked him about it? I asked him, what was the difference between this Xavier team that played DePaul and the Xavier team that he faced tonight? He said, home and away.
Mm. Ketch, I assume you watched the Xavier-DePaul game in preparation for this. What's the difference between that Xavier and this Xavier?
Home and away.
And why? What do they do so differently?
There's been three road wins in this league so far. This is not Xavier. It's not anything. We beat Villanova, and home we beat St. John's at home. This league is not. If you think you're just going to show up and win, this league is too good. It's too balanced. If you think you're going to go to DePaul and win, or go someplace and just show up and win, you're nuts. The league's way too good. Difference is home and away. They play that DePaul. It ain't rocket science. There's no difference. It's just you're on the road or you're home. They had 12,000 people. It's a great atmosphere. DePaul had 7,000 people for the home opener. It's a great atmosphere. You know, this league, you're just not going to win on the road very easily.
And the thing is, no one wants to hear this. No one wanted to hear it when I said it about Auburn, and no one wants to hear it about DePaul because they're not going to win enough games because, quite honestly, they don't have a very good coach, and they just don't defend well enough consistently to win a lot of games. But they're as talented as anyone in the Big East. Billy Garrett Jr. is a freaking stud. Tommy Hamilton is really good. Crockett can play. Like, they've got talent. It's not like they can't win a game if they don't put things together. They put things together against Xavier and played fairly well. Xavier didn't play great. So the positive sign is last year, to me, when you looked at the Xavier team on the road, they had played a lot of games where they just didn't give themselves a chance. Right. Either they just couldn't score, period, and weren't never really realistically going to win the game, or they played so horrid in a first half or so horrid in a second half that they had no shot to win these games. And it was like, yeah, maybe they hung around and cut it to 7 at one point or something in the second half to where you thought they had a chance, but they were never realistically going to win the game. This year, this team literally could have won every game it's played, like Joe Sunderman said. I mean, every single game, they've had a good shot, and they've made plays. That's the other thing. It's not like this team has wilted in the final moments. You've had Remy Abel sending it to overtime, making big free throws. You've had Trayvon Blewett hitting the big shot with 40 seconds against DePaul to look like he brought Xavier back, and then they have the stupid foul. But there's been plays made. They're not completely wilting. So, yes, I think there's a mental toughness issue, and most of it is just the fact that, okay, There's two senior leaders, Dee Davis and Matt Stainbrook, so this team isn't exactly young, but you are relying on guys like Trayvon Blewett, guys like J.P. McCarrick, guys like Miles Davis, who's not a very good defender. And by the way, Matt Stainbrook has had more issues than anyone defensively over the last few losses. So I think that's one of the things that you have to look at with this team, is that most of their issues is the fact that they have some young guys who just don't get it yet as far as defense goes. They stand up on a possession late in the game, and then they get beat for a layup. Or, you know, they're just not good enough all the time to win some of these games. But at home, they have been. And again, I tend to lean towards no. I think this is a pretty good team. Now, you have to show that you can win on the road at some point to be a good team. But at this point, the people just losing their minds and acting like they suck and Chris Mack is the worst person ever and D. Davis should never play a Division I game again because they lose a road game is, I don't understand that.
Rick, a couple stats for you. Every team in the Big East played three games so far, so there's been 15 total games played in conference play. 11 of those games, the home team has won. And in those 15 games, the number of games that were decided by 20 points or more, zero. So this is a league that, even though there may be a pretty broad spread between, say, Villanova and DePaul, on a night-to-night basis, it may not look that it may not look like that. That's one observation.
And I can't explain it, Dan. Like, that's the hardest part for me. I can't explain why it's that way. I'm trying. I've asked Miles Davis. He didn't really have a great answer for me. I asked him it was the crowd. He said, no, not really, but then kind of basically insinuated that it was the crowd noise. Then I asked Willard, and he said, like, you're an idiot for asking this, basically. It's just the way it is. So I don't know, but everyone that knows seems to just accept it. So that's where I'm kind of at.
I guess I'm kind of, you know, one thing that I did notice that was also that I also found interesting is Snow. I think you made the point today. You had posted where X was in all the computer rankings as of today, and X, I think, is 24th in the KenPom today. Interestingly, last year on this very same day, which was the day after they beat Marquette at home, they were like at 28. So they're kind of weirdly, they're kind of almost in the same position as they were last year.
Oh, I said that. They're very much in the same position.
And last year, obviously, the problem was that although they did pick up a couple of road wins with Butler and beating St. John's, they could never really turn the corner in some of those winnable road games. Marquette, Providence, Seton Hall, the teams that were bunched around them in the standings, they really struggled with on the road. And this year, you know, you look at Xavier and they're really well positioned now, but this really is a season that could go the same way as last year. If they can't, as Snow said, figure out a way to bring that toughness on the road. And you know, if they can't figure out how to do it, if Xavier ends up, you know, 9-9 or 10-8 in Big East play, and, you know, maybe they have another bad loss on the road. Maybe they don't beat UC. I mean, it's a resume that kind of starts to, even if the computer rankings are strong, it's a resume that kind of starts to resemble SMU from last year when they got left out, despite the fact that they had gaudy computer rankings and they had some decent wins at home in conference, but couldn't really get anything done on the road. So I think this is a season that to me is kind of poised on the brink. And over these next 3 weeks, they play at Butler. They play at Villanova, home to Marquette, at Providence, home to DePaul, away to Georgetown, away to Seton Hall. That's five games on the road out of seven, two very winnable games at home over that stretch, although as we saw with Seton Hall last year in the middle of a bunch of road games, not gimmies by any stretch of the imagination. And you just kind of think, if X can find a way to win two of those five road games, or you know, God forbid, three, they're going to be in a really strong position come the beginning of February. But if they can't, they're going to have a lot of ground to make up, and there's some tough games left on that schedule. So I think they're in an interesting spot right now.
Let me ask you this, though. Let me throw this out there. Is it unreasonable to think that this team could win out at home from what we've seen?
Unreasonable at all.
No, I mean, like, you look at it, and what it's going to come down to is that they're going to be playing, you know, the one game is going to kind of be Villanova, obviously, that you think, probably not, but
There'll be a dog in that game, but there'll be no more than like a 4-point underdog in that game. Well, and the rest of the game, they'll be favored.
Well, and here's my other thing with that game. It's the last home game of the year, and it's senior night. So, I mean, not that that really means anything, but you're going to have a packed house, and you're going to have a team that knows exactly what that game means. This game doesn't happen next week to where, okay, we've still got a chance to make up for it. That's going to be the game that the coaches are going to be able to point to and be like, this is how you get in the tournament. You want to play in the tournament, this is how you do it. So if the season plays out kind of as we expect it to, even with them losing road games and likely winning at home, if they win that game, that'd be huge for their resume, and I don't think it's unreasonable at all to think they could steal that one. So if they win out at home, they're sitting pretty good regardless of what happens on the road.
Yeah, it's good. The scheduling works out for them because they will get an opportunity probably. They'll get an opportunity to play a most likely a top 10 team on senior night, the last day of February, when sort of the focus is on these big conference games, and they're going to have an opportunity to notch a signature win in front of the cameras that last week of the season, similar to how they did last year in the Creighton game.
Well, and that's exactly.
Although obviously with losing to Seton Hall, you know, with Stainbrook getting hurt, Villanova, they played really well, but they couldn't get over the hump. You know, it was a little, it kind of fell apart on them a little bit, but the schedule sets up nicely for X, I think, from that perspective.
That's what I was going to say, though. You mentioned the Creighton game. That's exactly what I was going to say. They've been kind of good in these situations under Chris Mack. These big win needed at home against a ranked team type of thing, they've done pretty well with.
Yeah, the Memphis game comes to mind, too, right. A couple years ago. Guys, I guess when we look at this team, let's talk about the Seton Hall game a little bit because all three of us were there. Snow, we heard Joe talk about the transition offense, and I thought that was the biggest factor in Xavier's ability to win that game is that when their offense stagnated, they were able to get baskets in transition. What did you see them doing defensively in the second half that made them more effective?
I think a big part of it, now granted, I didn't see 1 second of the DePaul game, so I'm not really sure how that went. But Dee and Remy are now so locked in on the defensive end that they can almost shut another backcourt out, and it makes it really difficult with the size down low that Xavier has for people to score. So I don't think Xavier's doing necessarily anything a little bit different. I just think they're better within their system. And I know people don't necessarily get this because it's an instant gratification, whatever the heck society thing we're talking about. But like the reason Xavier does the same thing every single time is so that at the end of the year, they've done it so much that they're good at it defensively. And I think you're starting to see them turn the corner. Like, they all know what they're doing now. Remy knows what he's doing.
That's huge.
And Stainbrook, I know his numbers look the same as what they were last year, roughly, give or take. He hasn't played as well. He hasn't been as good defensively. I think he's starting to be like, you know, Matt's a bit of a different dude. Basketball's not, you know, he doesn't live and die with basketball. But I think he's starting to realize, like, this could be the end of my basketball career. And I think you might see him turn the corner and start to have a much better finish and care a lot more on the defensive end. Not that he didn't care, but it's just a different focus and locked-in-ness when you're a senior and you can start counting the games you have left.
No, I do think you make a great point about Matt, though. I think there's been enough challenging and calling out of him going on in the last few weeks, and I think it's been very calculated by Chris Mack and the rest of the staff. And they've been relentless. Usually, Matt's kind of the guy you let go during practice because, like, to be honest, you need his legs saved. You don't need him wrestling around on the floor with Jalen and tearing an ACL or anything. So they kind of get it. They kind of give Matt a pass in some aspects, but it hasn't been that way the last few weeks. They've gotten after him and really called him out because he has, quite frankly, just played a soft game. He's been just a face-up player and has made no team account for him really in the post. Now, he did it he did it a lot against Seton Hall, and he did a little bit not against DePaul, but in the Georgetown game before that, he did some things, especially on the glass, where he was a little more physical. But overall, he hasn't been the same guy, I agree. And I think I agree with you. I think it's kind of all of a sudden hitting him that, okay, I need to pick it up. He's looked a little bit different to me. His attitude's looked a little bit different in practice. And he's been a little more rah-rah, which is never his style. But it looks like, you know, there's a little more of a competitive nature coming out of Matt Stainbrook the last week or so.
Yeah, and he had a couple nice plays in the big run at the end of the Seton Hall game that put that away. You know, he walled up at the rim a couple times. I thought Seton Hall did a pretty nice job for the first 30 minutes or so of that game of passing around Xavier's pack line. They moved the ball really well, it seems like, and they were able to find the seams. They were able to run so many screens that they could get mismatches down low, and it seemed like Delgado and a couple of other big men were really getting low on the block and getting into great position for baby hooks. But toward the end of that game, it felt like Remy Abel got up on Sterling Gibbs more, and Seton Hall just didn't have that fluidity. And then at the offensive end, Matt gets the finish off the off that quick play that they run every once in a while, and then also did a really nice job later of basically boxing out two guys and clearing them out off the baseline for Remy Abel to score all the way from the corner on a drive. So,
if he's not sealing that guy on the block, if he's doing it 8 feet from the basket, that doesn't happen.
Right.
But instead, he's posting up on the block and sealing that dude deep, and it gets a layup.
And Dan, the other thing for me is, you didn't get to hear it because you were at the game, and Rick didn't hear it because he was checking out TV monitors next to him. But at halftime, you know, like Max said, like, we can't get punked on the glass like we just did.
Mm. Yeah, it was right after Trayvon gave up that.
Well, it was actually the last two buckets that Seton Hall
was Jalen.
Yeah,
I think one was Jalen, one was Matt.
One was off an air ball where Jalen Reynolds just kind of lost his man for a second.
Yeah.
The guy was able to score. And then the last possession of the half, they do a really nice job for 30 seconds.
Great defense.
And then Trayvon loses his man for a layup. And that was during the period where
the thing was Trayvon didn't lose his man. He was boxing out his man in head position, and he let the guy push him underneath the rim, get a rebound, and lay it back in. And that's where Mac just freaking – I was watching Mac on the sideline because I was kind of in that baseline view. And
you
he
sure
just
it was
blew
Mac who
his
you were
gasket.
Watching?
Yes, I am.
Video evidence would not indicate you were watching Mac. However, your point remains valid that
And also, you can understand Chris's frustration because that little 3-minute window right at the end of the first half was the best Xavier played, and they were starting to build a lead. They had it up to, I think, 8 at one point. And
yeah,
then
right
seven,
off the three consecutive transition buckets got them up to 8.
Right, and then they give up those two stupid, unnecessary baskets at the end of the half to keep Seton Hall within 5. And the problem Xavier's had all season, and it continued in this game, is that they've been ahead 15 times they've had the lead at halftime. But the problem that they have is that they come out sluggish out of the locker room, and that's been a problem all year, even in the games that they've won. And Seton Hall, sure enough, gets the first 5 points of the second half. They get the lead. I think they were up 3 points maybe at the first TV timeout. So you can understand Chris's frustration because you've got the opportunity to give yourself a cushion at the end of the first half if you finish. And those two times, those particular guys didn't finish plays on the defensive end. And that, I think, is the most I don't know, you know, I don't talk to coaches as much as you guys do, but I have to think that that's one of the more disheartening things for a team from a morale standpoint. When you really bust your ass 33 seconds playing defense and then give up a stupid bunny because you miss an assignment or you let your man push you under the basket because you got 5 guys, you know, really working their tails off for the full possession, and then something stupid happens at the end and you know the possession's basically a loss at that point.
Well, and that's the difference between them winning these road games and them losing those road games. It hasn't been they're getting killed and they don't have a chance and they need to shoot way better or something. It's they can't make a few plays. They can't finish off a few plays. They've done some things they need to do down the road. They've hit some big shots. They've played some great defensive possessions and earned stops when they need to, or almost earned a stop, but then they don't secure a rebound. They don't get a 50-50 ball. It's those small things that are the difference right now between them winning games, and that's what they're trying to get to the team to understand. And that was a huge theme in practice the day before that Seton Hall game on Tuesday. It was just a ton of that. You know, it's not, guys, we can't say it's okay, get them next time. We can't say the game's won over 40 minutes. We need to get this done now. We need to get a stop this possession. And they made one defensive unit stay out on the floor during a drill for literally like 35 minutes, and it was like 25 straight possessions where they couldn't secure either a defensive rebound or stop, whatever, and they just left them out there. They never switched it for them. So that's what they're trying to get through to them. And, you know, you saw it at home against Seton Hall. Can they show it on the road is the ultimate question. And that's what they're going to be judged on, and rightfully so.
I wanted to make a comment about D. Davis in the Seton Hall game because I thought this was, if not the best, probably in the top 3 games that he's played at Xavier. I was just looking at his stat sheet, you know, and even leaving aside defense, he was extraordinarily efficient on offense. Missed a couple threes, but, you know, that's okay because he was finishing those opportunities he got at the rim. And he had 6 assists and 2 turnovers, and both turnovers were – really ambitious passes in transition, trying to get guys free. There was one that he threw the ball over Trayvon's head, and there was one that he threw way in front of Remy that went out of bounds. And those are the kind of turnovers that, you know, given the way Xavier was playing in that game, given the struggles that they were having in the half court sometimes and how good they were in transition, those are the kind of turnovers that you don't really beat a guy up for making. And I thought he played really I thought he played really within himself, other than those two passes, and I thought he was just terrific in this game. And I hope that he can put together some of those same performances on the road so people can get off his back, because he showed exactly how important he is to this offense and defense in that game.
Yeah, no, I mean, I couldn't agree more. We've kind of been banging that drum all year, so I don't really need to go into how important we feel D. Davis is, but that doesn't excuse him from the mistakes he does make. I mean, it's not like anyone's saying he's been perfect, because he's had his own struggles on the road. It's just people are so over the top with his criticism. Like, he was not the reason they lost the DePaul game at all, in any way, shape, or form.
The problem, as always, is that when he does things that are outside, that are sort of out, when he's a little bit out of control, or he's trying to do things that are too ambitious, he's the guy that's always got the ball in his hand. He's the one everyone's looking at. And when he does something, when he tries to go in against 2 6'10" guys and gets his shot blocked into the stratosphere, or when he throws a bad pass or something like that, it's obvious and everyone sees it. People don't see it quite as much when Remy overcommits on a guy and leaves a man wide open for a cut behind him, or when James Farr is slow, like on the three that I think I can't remember who hit it. Mobley hit.
Yeah, I think it was Mobley.
The Seton Hall bench, where James got sucked in on penetration and didn't close out fast enough. Those aren't as obvious as D. Davis's mistakes on the offensive end. So I understand why people kind of focus in on him. But I think he was great in that game. Another guy who we mentioned in passing was Remy Abel, who, although he didn't have a great game from an offensive standpoint, he hit one of the biggest shots of the game, which was the transition three to put Xavier ahead, which was a lead that they did not relinquish. And then also, I thought he did a great job on Sterling Gibbs, especially in the second half. You know, Gibbs a great guard, Gibbs a great shooter. He has a little bit of that two Holloway thing, where whenever they needed a bucket in that second half, he would kind of just take a couple dribbles and dot his man from 20 feet. But I thought Remy did a great job for the most part in that game. And I think, again, you're starting to see the value that he adds to this team, especially when, as in a game like this, they didn't need him to score a lot, so he could really, really key in on his defensive assignment.
Well, Snow mentioned that Remy and D were so locked in that Seton Hall game, and they basically just took Cena and Gibbs completely out of the game, and that's completely true. But one of the ways I know for sure that they were completely locked in is because Seton Hall didn't attempt one backdoor cut in that entire game with their guards. And when they're doing that perimeter pitch or dribble weave, handoff, whatever you want to call it, they constantly wait for you to overcommit and try to slip and get ahead of the handoff, and they cut back door before they actually take the handoff. And that didn't happen one time because Xavier was locked in and knew they were going to try to do it, just knew the game assignment, and that was big time. The thing about Remy, it might have been Snow again that mentioned this, is he knows what the defensive game plan is now. He understands what everyone's supposed to be doing, and he's good enough now that he can make the whole team better. Like, he can lock down his assignment, be in help position all the time, be super active, get a deflection, get his hand on a strip, whatever. He can do it all now because he knows what's going on. He's not trying to figure out things himself and giving up the backdoor cuts on an overcommit like you talked about, Dan. So I think he's been great. I mean, Kevin Willard talked about it in the post game last night.
Snow, your thoughts on Trayvon Blewett? He had a couple games where he struggled, but he seems to have come out of it in the second half of the DePaul game, and then was very good last night.
Yeah, I mean, I think Trayvon got into a situation where, one, he got sick. Not to make excuses, but if you're on the floor, you're healthy. But the reality is, he got sick and he wasn't practicing. And then, two, he's a freshman who had everybody telling him how great he was for 2 weeks. Then some adversity hit, and things for the first time in his basketball career weren't easy, and I don't think he necessarily adjusted as well as he's fully capable of. Well, now he's adjusted back, and he's figured it out, and, you know, he's kind of normal again. And I think that's just what's going to happen, and There's a reason Trayvon wasn't the number one player in the country, because he's not that overwhelming like an Anthony Davis, where he can get through some of those growing pains and you don't notice it. But now I think you're going to see the same type of Trayvon you saw the first four or five games and what you've seen the last couple games, where he's going to score, he's going to make plays, and
he's,
you know, he's going to
get beat defensively.
Yeah. And but I'll say this, he actually hasn't been, at least in, against Seton Hall, he wasn't bad defensively.
Yeah, but he's had at least one or two in the second half of the last three games where he just gets his doors completely blown off. Yeah. Last night he got matched up with Gibbs in a bad situation where they screened a couple times, and Gibbs, I mean, just took him right to the rim for a layup, and same thing happened in the DePaul game with Garrett. So, I mean, if teams are looking to get him switched on the screens just like they are, you know, one of the bigs, so... He's not great defensively. He can't keep a guard in front of him, but he knows what he's supposed to be doing at least.
Yeah,
and he rebounds really well.
Tremendously.
You know. Hey, so the last guy I wanted to talk about in terms of the Seton Hall game is a player who has become a favorite of mine, and I'm kind of embarrassed because like it's so predictable
because
that
we knew it was going to happen.
Yeah, but I didn't realize how. Like, and Joe Sunderman actually brought it up, how much, like, just mayhem. I think that should be his nickname, Mayhem Makura, because it's just everything he did in the first half of that game entertained me. Like, I was literally up there just howling with laughter after, like, the 3 minutes he was in there, because he hits some ridiculous fadeaway, first of all, right after he gets on the floor. Then he comes down, tries a heat check three, misses it by, like, 4 feet. He draws this flop in front of the Seton Hall bench.
Well, here's the thing. Let's talk about that play real quick before you continue. He did get pushed a little bit. He got pushed to the ground, but here's the thing. He falls down, gets up with zero reaction, and that other dude's looking kind of pissed off. I'm dying to, like, that's happening more often than not when JP's in the game. He's involved in something like that seemingly every game. He's doing something. Like, clearly he is getting in dudes' heads.
He had that ridiculous sort of, I don't know if it was a Walton style hook pass on the I think to D Davis for a finish on a fast break, and then he completely got his doors blown off by seeing at the other end so bad that he almost fell down, and this all happened within the space of maybe like 2 minutes and 45 seconds of game time. And then he came in the second half, did a really nice job on the offensive glass, got a couple stick backs for X when they needed him. But the guy just seems to produce when he's in there. I mean, obviously he's a defensive liability, but he's been a really nice spark for them. And it seems like he really feeds off the crowd at home. It would be nice to see him do the same in some of these road games, because X could really benefits, I think, from that energy. The energy that him and Jalen bring off the bench.
Yeah, and the funniest thing to me is just this kamikaze style. And Chris Mack put it perfectly in practice the other day because he was mad at the team for not boxing him out. But you can't let JP Makura just run through the lane and jump off a trampoline and try to get on the offensive glass. And I mean, that's exactly what he's doing, is just crashing ridiculously hard from the wing every time and just leaping into the air and trying to tip a ball away or come down with it. And it's actually been fairly successful for him. He got a couple stick backs in the Seton Hall game because of it.
I'm still waiting for him to put somebody on a poster, and he's going to do it.
It's going to happen. Oh yeah.
It's like JP's been watching film with Tyler Durkers or something. Cause that's what Durkers used to do. Just run from the top of the key, jump
and just leap,
get a rebound somehow. And like, no one accounted for him. Like, what the hell just happened?
I don't really blame people for not boxing him out, honestly, because every time I see it happen, I'm like, how did that happen? Like, I did not predict JP Makura would leap from the opposite side of the lane and catch that rebound.
I am convinced that he will be the next Xavier player to get punched in the face on the floor during a basketball game. I will say that. I don't know when it's going to happen, but it's going to happen.
He's sneaky, though, because I don't hear him talking.
Don't count Jalen out of that.
yeah, I mean, but he's always in the mix. But I think Jalen's
a pretty big moron to punch Jalen Reynolds in the face.
Jalen's got the reach, though. I don't know that anyone's going to get to his face before that guy's already been dotted. I agree with you on Makura.
All right, looking forward to Saturday. Snow, you are Indianapolis based. You've seen Butler play a few
times. Hold on. I think we need to talk about one Brandon Randolph.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry.
That's been brought up on the board, and I get why. I mean, his 11 points on 4 of 4 shooting, which he nailed three threes, in 19 minutes against Missouri literally seems like it was 2 years ago. He falls into this like no man's land where he doesn't necessarily make any glaring mistakes, but he just doesn't play with a lot of confidence. And really, he got his opportunity in that Missouri game, played pretty well, played a ton in the Auburn game, didn't do a whole lot. The team was kind of out of sorts because obviously that was the game that D fouled out of, was in foul trouble throughout. And the team kind of obviously lacked that punch when he was in it because Brandon just doesn't have that confidence and doesn't guide the team the same way. I think the coach has kind of lost confidence in him again. He lost Carlos yesterday just on a simple cut to the basket that gave an easy layup. And then he did finally make up for it, though, and hit a three, which is his first point since the Auburn game. He's 6-for-9 on the year from beyond the arc. I think he needs to shoot the ball with more confidence when he's in the game. I don't understand why he's not more confident on the offensive end, because he hasn't played poorly when he's had his opportunities. But he's got to figure it out. I mean, he's been passed up clearly, and it's not going to get any easier going forward. So he needs to get it going and provide value to this team, or he's going to find himself the odd man out for his career probably.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, next year you have to consider the fact that you're going to have Edmund Sumner. And I don't know. I mean, but you know, and the Seton Hall game is a little bit different because obviously the – you know, with D playing the way he did, he played 38 minutes. That's not, you know, usually what you see from D. Usually he doesn't play that many minutes. So there wasn't really that much room for Brandon. But also, X has not looked terrible when they've played these no point guard sets where Miles Davis is sort of the nominal point guard. Whoa. Or, you know, even maybe Trayvon brings the ball up the floor every once in a while. They haven't looked bad in those sets. It's allowed them to go a little bit bigger. And they kind of have been more efficient in those sets than they have with Brandon running the team over the last three or four games. So
I'll say it without any hesitation. Miles Davis is this team's best option as the backup point guard. And at times when D struggled, Miles might be their best option at point. He just makes plays, and he has feel. Like, he's not quick. He's not a super ball handler that's going to mystify you or break a press by himself. But if a team's just in a half-court man-to-man, Miles Davis has been pretty good at making plays for this team and running the show.
I think Miles has done a good job. He's a real high IQ player, and he just knows how to get things done. So, yeah, I mean, Brandon's going to have to – he's going to have to do more. The fact that he's not turning the ball over is almost a little bit of a problem because it means he's not doing enough.
Exactly.
So I think for him finding that balance, and we'll see what happens as the year goes on and just how this one goes.
Yeah, I mean, the rest of the year they're going to be playing 2 to 3 games a week, basically, and it's not going to be possible for D. Davis to be out there 35 to 38 minutes every single night. They're going to need some production from that backup point guard spot, and there's going to be nights that they can't just plug Miles Davis in or have Remy bring the ball up 2 or 3 possessions. They're going to need production from him. So hopefully he can find that confidence and turn the corner. But moving forward to the Butler game, what I was going to ask you, Snow, is can you give us your quick scouting report on the Bulldogs so far this season and what you expect on Saturday?
Quite honestly, I think they've greatly overachieved relative to their talent level. You know, I've seen them practice a lot. I was at the game on Tuesday night where they fell to the Providence Friars. And they have played Providence already. What'd you say?
They have played Providence already.
Yeah, they have played Providence. Funny how
Providence, that works. Providence has played games this year. I mean,
yeah.
Just not against Xavier.
No.
I get what you're saying. I get it. I get that now.
So I think this is a game where Xavier's the better team. They're bigger. They're more athletic. They're better shooting. It's just, can Xavier be locked in? And I think someone on the board brought up an interesting point, and Rick didn't answer the question. He went with, you know, like a football coach's answer where you ask him about the running backs and he talks about his receivers. But
I don't know what you're talking about.
How they're going to match up with Butler, because to me, you want to put D. Davis on Kellen Dunham because D is so far in Kellen Dunham's head after the last 2 years.
That's exactly what I said.
Well, hold on. And then you start talking about matchups that are never going to happen because those two lineups are never going to be on the damn court.
What are you talking about? Why wouldn't they be? I said that'll be their best lineup.
Let's see what Xavier's starting lineup is going to be. D. Davis, yeah. Remy Abel, yeah. Trayvon Blewett, yeah. either James or Jalen and Stainbrook, and you just went with Stainbrook off the court.
Okay. That you're correct. That will be their starting lineup. But what is their two most popular lineups as soon as one of the bigs sub out? D. Davis, Miles Davis, Remy Abel, Trayvon Blewett at the floor, four, and then Jalen Reynolds at the five. After they take one of the bigs out, it's always Trayvon at the four. So I don't see why. Like, I think Trayvon will play at the four more than he won't in that game. I don't think they'll play two bigs most of the game.
I don't know. I think they'll play bigs. Because while Cam Woods and Shravitz are good players, they're not stretch the floor players. They can make a shot on you. But
Shravitz
you're not
wants
about
to be. He wants to be.
Yeah, well, he isn't. I can tell you that much. So
I'll remember that when he hits 4 threes on pick and pops, by the way, on Saturday.
So you're going to play your bigs because that's where your advantage is, because the last 2 years, Xavier has annihilated Butler in the paint, like to the point of embarrassment.
That's true.
So you're not going to take them off the court. Where the interesting part is, say you want Deion Kellen like I'm suggesting, that almost means you're going to have Trayvon either on Roosevelt Jones, not ideal, or Alex Barlow, not ideal. So I'll be interested to see how they do it and if they do decide to go with Deion Kellen.
Is it possible that they could play Abel on Dunham so they could free up D to guard Barlow so they have a more traditional sort of defensive look?
I just don't think they want Trayvon guarding Jones at all.
Yeah, that's where
that's
the
worst
is.
Possible matchup, I think.
Yeah, that's where the issue is.
Abel will guard Jones, in my opinion. He's their best player. He makes their offense go. If you cut him off, I don't think they create much.
Is Barlow – I mean, I understand that Trayvon would struggle to guard most point guards, but Barlow isn't – he doesn't wow you with quickness, so is
but
that
he's got
a
GCL
Trayvon
toughness. That's the issue, Dan.
Look,
that's the real issue.
There is no
here
question about that, and I am perfectly aware of that. I showed it today when I walked into work through 1 degree temperatures. But I feel like you know, Barlow's not the guy that's going to go around you. I mean, he's not going to completely blow Trayvon's doors off. It seems like that could be a manageable matchup for a few minutes at a time.
Yeah, I mean, I almost think what they'll do is put Trayvon on Roosevelt Jones and basically, in essence, just not guard Roosevelt Jones and keep Trayvon 1 foot in the paint the entire time, which is kind of what – I mean, Providence, like, it was embarrassing how they guarded Roosevelt Jones. Like, they went so far underneath the screen, like, it was painful. So I think that might be what Xavier does. So to me, that'll be interesting.
Just sag off Jones completely and cut off the penetration is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Let him shoot?
Yeah.
That would make sense.
So what will be more interesting is I'll be watching it from a bar in Dallas. So that'll be even more.
God, you're big time. Going to the national title game, I assume?
Yes, sir.
For the record, though, this is kind of the situation Xavier's finding themselves in most games. I mean, it seems like most teams they have faced have not been as big as them and have a lot of times, as soon as they make their first sub, they go to a small lineup. So Xavier's had to kind of deal with this every game where they figure out a balance between imposing their will on offense with two bigs in the lineup versus matching up defensively when they try to play smaller. And they've done a lot of both, so I think we'll see a mixture of the two. I think my lineup that I threw out there in the message board is their best defensive lineup, their best defensive matchups for the game. But, I mean, I get what you're saying, Snow, and you bring up kind of a good strategy there for their starting lineup.
And the thing is, a lot of the times when teams go small, take for instance Seton Hall, Brandon Mobley. Mobley's a threat to make threes. Can Cam Woods make a three? Sure. Is he a threat to make one? No.
Right.
And that's a significant difference, is when Butler goes small, they don't necessarily get better shooting.
Rick, I'll ask you the question that was posed on the message board, which is about this Butler coaching situation. And Snow, you can chime in to the extent you want to.
Why don't we let Snow talk about this? Because I'd rather hear his opinion.
So
I mean, I have lunch with Chris Holtmann.
Yeah, so Chris Holtmann, former coach at Gardner-Webb, is now he's been given the job. I assume
he's got a 5-year contract to be the head coach of the Butler Bulldogs.
Okay, so how do you think this dynamic is going to work with Miller, you know, having whatever happened and him sort of leaving that position? How is this going to affect Butler going forward? Because the only situation that anybody could think of that was kind of the same was when Rick Majerus had to step down right before the season. Now, obviously, Jim Cruz's situation was a lot different than Chris Holtmann. But how do you see that affecting Butler's program moving forward?
Stability is good, and I think finally for the first time in 36 months or so, 24 months, whatever the heck it's been, they have stability. and they're going to be able to move forward. And Chris Holtman's a really good basketball coach. He won at Gardner-Webb, which is not easy. You know, he coached under John Gross. He knows what he's doing. Butler's obviously overachieved this year under his leadership. I think it's the right hire. I think it's good for Butler. I think they've got stability in place, and I think the program will go in a positive direction.
Rick, anything else on the Butler game?
I think here on the Butler game, I think Xavier matches up well with them. I think this is one of their more winnable games on the road that's left. I mean, I know Marquette's not very good. We talked about that. But I just think in terms of Trayvon's going to Indy, I kind of expect him to have a big game. D, I think, usually plays well at Butler. I think Xavier's done well at Butler recently in terms of this is just kind of more of a rivalry game to them at this point, for me, is what it seemed like in the past. It doesn't feel as much as like, oh, this is a road game. It feels more of like the UC game where it's like you kind of throw records out the window. It doesn't matter how good the teams are. It's always going to be a weird game and kind of scrap it out. So that's kind of more what I'm looking for in this game. I think Xavier, again, is a lot more talented than Butler. I think Butler's overachieved, just no mention. So matchups-wise, I like what Xavier can do to them and the situations they can put them in. I think Xavier can get the win. But again, it'll be a close game, and it'll come down to do they get those stops for the full shot clock and a full 20 minutes in the second half and all those other cliches. So we'll see.
Okay, Rick, anything else you want to hit on during tonight's podcast? Well, that's a bad choice of words after last night.
All right. Look, like, I mean, she's a nice girl. I don't get, like, here's the thing that's weird about this, though. When you're sitting next to someone like that, and I'm sure it's not that weird for her because I'm looking at her mentions and she's getting all these creepy guys, like, saying, hey, like, I'm going to molest you after the game from Section 213, smiley face. So
wait, people say that?
Yes. So it's probably not that weird that my notifications in the corner of my screen keep popping up saying, like, dude, sweet seat tonight, bro. And then, like, people posting pictures of me. Yeah. And then people posting pictures of me looking at a replay monitor and, like, somehow making that out to be that I was checking her out. But if you look at the replay, which I did last night on TV, you clearly see it was a play where someone got fouled. I can't remember exactly who it was. I think it was Miles Davis, but they didn't call it. So I'm looking up at the scoreboard at first to try to see a replay on there. Then I immediately look over to her monitor, which was just off to her left, and you can clearly see that's what I'm doing. Here's the thing. I'm a more practical guy when it comes to women. I don't get...
I can't wait to hear this.
Yeah, see, this is what I don't get about a lot of guys out here and all the tweets that I'm getting where everyone's like one guy was like, he looks scared in that picture. I'm like, scared? Like, what am I scared about? Here's the thing about her. I have no shot with her. I'm not scared. I'm not nervous. I'm not even in the game. Like, I'm not playing. I'm just doing my job. Like, she's going to ask me questions about whether it's James Fair or James Farr, and I'm going to answer them. And then I'm going to unplug her charger at the end of the night. That's it. She's gonna go home to her fiance.
What
I'm not in
gentleman.
This game, so I'm not worried about this. I'm not sweating this. This isn't weird to be sitting next to her. Like, if you feel weird about that, you just haven't been around enough women in your life, because there's a lot of hot women out there, and I prefer to, like, get nervous about, like, the sevens that I meet in a bar later that night. Like, that's what I was worried when I went to Applebee's and got my PBR after the game and there was a 7 two seats down to my right. That's what I was worried about, because that was the game that I was playing that night. And that's where I had to make sure I was on point.
I will verify that Rick and I were sitting in the media section on the floor at MSG for the opening round games last year in the Big East tournament, and Aaron Andrews walked right by us, and Rick barely even gave her a glance. So a consummate professional, even though we weren't really covering games that night.
Yeah, like, see, the 12s just don't do anything for me. Like, women that are that good looking, I'm not worried about. That doesn't make sense.
Well, Rick, I completely agree with you. It is worth noting that Beth Long thought that was one of the funniest photos she's ever seen.
Oh, I mean, I'm gonna talk to Beth Long. Like, that. Like, why are we worried about Allie LaForce, guys? Come on.
All right. Okay.
I'm with you, Rick. I know my own scouting report.
This podcast is going places. We had Joe Sunderman on tonight.
Yeah.
That seems like it was a while ago.
It's been downhill since. All right.
From classy to trashy, the Dana and Victory podcast.
One last thing before we leave. I have to we have to give some props to friend of the show DJ Hodge for winning the Dana and Victory podcast Pro Football Prediction League this year after starting like 0-9, which I don't know what that says about the rest of us, but DJ has won some prize to be determined. I don't think a prize was ever determined, and did a pretty solid job over the last 10 weeks of the season, to the point that I kind of suspect that he was getting some sort of tips from some Vegas type.
Well, but do you think he could do that again? If he put up a pretty good percentage there, we would have made some dough if we would have been actually betting those games, right? That was against the spread.
Yeah, he would have taken all the money Snow lost.
Yeah, I mean, well, like, I wouldn't have bet. I wouldn't have bet Snow's games. That was the thing. What about the fact that Snow was the only one who talked any smack before this started about him clearly being in first place after like week two, and then he immediately went to the cellar and never returned?
I'm good at being obnoxious. It's what I do well. Again, I know my own scouting report.
Yeah, and you. But here's the thing: you usually claim to be right. You were like rarely right in that pick'em. You were the worst.
Yeah, details.
All right, I think we should put this one out of its misery, Rick.
I'd say so. Well, for Joe Sunderman, the legend Brian
he
Snow,
probably doesn't want to be associated with this at this point.
Yeah, so, but it was a great podcast guest to have on, you got to admit
right,
that.
Right, that's right.
I was pretty pumped about it. So, yeah, the legend Brian Snow and Dan, we appreciate all your work as well. This has been another edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only available on MusketeerReport.com. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Zipper noise.